Hello, would you please state your name, the date, the time, and your location?
My name is Tony, and it is 1:21 p.m., October 14th, and I'm currently in New Haven, Connecticut, United States.
And the year is 2022.
The year is 2022.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial share alike?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here with me today. Would you just start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening? What would you want them to know about you?
My name is Tony. I am Asian migrant, F1 student visa holder currently, and non-binary, and currently, I'm studying at Yale School of Architecture for my master's, but also I'm a practicing sex worker as well as an organizer with Red Canary Sun based in New York.
Tell me a story about your life during the pandemic.
I actually started escorting during the pandemic, and that was primarily because lack of income. Graduating in 2020 was difficult. There was a lot of plans got messed up by having the thesis like cut short. Wasn't able to move to a different city as I was planning, and then so didn't really look for jobs. Both, like in New York and in LA. So then ended up like not having a job as I wanted up till like November, December of that year. And then that's when I was like, you know what, I'm gonna take a dip into this, and just so I can pay my bills, because I was also paying my rent in cash at the time. So does this all make sense? Yeah, so I started escorting, and then about half year in, and I uploaded my bio or my profile onto the platforms, and the sec and then the, actually like the day I had a I got confirmed with a client, and then so I had my first client the second day after I like put on my profile. Would that be like a good story, or should I stop there? So it's, I guess, half a year in, fast forward to like April 2021. This is when I started organizing with Red Canary Sun as well. Because we are kind of like a sex worker organization. Most of the core members are sex workers in the industry. So it was also at the time of the vigil for the Atlanta shooting that happened a year ago, that remind me of the Red Canary Sun's existence in the city. So I reached out and started doing outreach for them in Flushing, because at the time I was living very close to Flushing, and then that's where I started to like visit parlors. I started talking to ladies in the community, and also kind of started my own process of reflection, being, a migrant in this country, which was very, before that, I think it was very suppressed, because it's something that I wanted to overcome. And so not really like discuss, because I hope that one day I don't have to deal with this anymore. But I think seeing these people, living in a state that's so much more marginalized than I am, maybe, and then that is the constant immediate, I guess, experience that they don't know where the end is. Help me to understand, like, hey, like I'm also in a like sort of permanent transient space as well, and then that should be, questioned, thought through, and challenged, and just processed. So yeah, and then I think that process that experience really helped me to start also like understand what pandemic how is affected by the pandemic, because we all know by now that it's such a like a permanent transient space as well, but at a time I think we're all like, oh, this is going to be over in a year or two, you know, so like I was also in that kind of like in that denial that like we don't have to really process this, it's going to be over soon, like let's just move on after it's over, but instead like, you know, start to process like, hey, like this is gonna just be the everyday from now. And that really helped me to like, you know, like reposition myself to, and then kind of started doing the work that I'm doing today in school as well. Yeah.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, would you say something about your experiences with health and healthcare infrastructure pre-pandemic?
Yeah. Pre-pandemic. So I was doing college. I was under school international student insurance. It was a pretty okay insurance, even though I didn't have too much like interaction with it at the time because I was not on any medication other than PrEP. So it was, I mean, that was kind of my first like healthcare experience in this country. Also, I grew up, my father is a surgeon in a public hospital back in China. So I grew up, never had to go into a pharmacy or a hospital because my dad could like prescribe anything for me if I needed. So I kind of never really had any direct interaction with the healthcare system anywhere, period, in my life. So like finding my own doctor, I mean my primary provider in a city when I was in college, and like, you know, going there and then like start a conversation with a doctor, it was like all new to me. And it was kind of, it was smooth for me because I don't know, I guess I was like on a very comprehensive insurance plan, so everything kind of worked out. I didn't have to worry too much, other than sometimes my doctor is a little bit, how do I put this, being concerning about stuff that she didn't have to be concerned about because it's like none of your business. When it approaches like, you know, like why I'm taking PrEP, why I'm like need to, you know, get STI shots or stuff like that, I feel like there are questions that I was asked that were not necessarily like part of their job. And then that's the summary of like the situation before pandemic.
Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19?
Yeah, that was December 2019. So I heard from, I think I heard from the Chinese Twitter platform Weibo, where people started talking about something's happening in Wuhan. The government is trying to like lock down like the information, so like not too many people know exactly what happened, but it has spreaded across the ocean to the States, and then so like people knew that something happened in Wuhan. And then I was traveling in Europe that winter, and it was kind of just like off the news until I come back to the States in January before the semester started. By the time I was still pretty much like, I think it developed to a point that people were thinking this is like a second wave of SARS, which was regional, but like high death rate, and like people were very, very worried, but like people in the States are not so worried. So like we were kind of feeling, lucky that we're not in there in this like authoritarian, like a government controlled country while like another SARS is gonna happen. And then that was till like, I mean, there's, I think there's then, I think the first case that we like officially heard in the States was like maybe around March or something, if my memory is correct. But between January and March, like everybody's like, of course it's already here. It's just, you know, like why there's no cases reported yet. This is just stupid and confusing. But also like it was Trump, right? Was it still Trump? Yeah. So then there was also like, you know, like we don't know what this government's going to do, like just period. So like nothing is really surprising either. So like I kind of just were waiting like when and where the first case is going to like be reported. And I was kind of like, of course it's going to be New York. So, and I was in New York at the time. But yeah, I guess that's the first, like my first reaction to it. But I was also, I don't remember if I was worried too much about my own life here in New York at the time yet, because I was like, yeah, I can't remember. I was worried. I was very worried. I was very, very worried because I was like, I knew this is how this can roll out. And then I know like the state, like this America is a country that's so like hard to control the population when it comes to these kind of things. It's going to be really bad. And in my head, it was like, this is going to be much worse than what happened in China. And, but that was kind of it. Like, there's no other like measures that I could take to like understand what that kind of life could be, because it was, I don't know. I guess also didn't have time to process further beyond that point. Yeah, that was, yeah.
I'd love to hear any reflections you have on sort of how previous experience with SARS shaped your reaction to what was happening here and the difference between the two locations and sort of what you were thinking about being here in the US for COVID.
Yeah, I think disease control is a very, very, now I learned, I think at the time I didn't really have a sense that it's different, in so different in different countries. I think my experience with SARS was the only like reference point that I had to understand any kind of disease control, even like, you know, reading about history of like the Black Death in Europe, like those are just not like, I couldn't really assimilate like other than the numbers and the facts of these pandemics, like nothing about like the kind of like the ambience of like these events really, like I could process, I guess. So for me, when SARS happened, the most extreme situation would be like we have body temperature three times a day. I was in elementary school. We were outside of Shanghai, so kind of far from Hong Kong. So we were relatively okay. My county never had a single case reported, but also like all the borders, the road, the streets were all blocked, and everybody had to get checked. And like if you cross like towns or counties at a time, I think. So that's the most extreme measures that were taken at a time. But it was doable and easy because how Chinese government run the country. And then, so I was reflecting back to those things, and I was like, none of this would be able to be like actually implemented here to any town, or like New York can never be in lockdown. So I'm like, how this is gonna roll out? Like what's gonna happen? And then lockdown happened. It just hit so fast. I was notified the school's gonna close tomorrow, on the day of, and this is during my thesis year. And then like for me, the hardest part to process was and at the time I was at Cooper, it was in East Village, and I was living in Alphabet City. It's kind of like a 15-minute walk from school, and I was living with two roommates at the time. And then they moved back to one to Miami, one to Long Island, like the second week after school closed. No, like the third day after school closed, the weekend. And so I was left alone in our apartment in Alphabet City when I think more than half of the people living there were gone at the time. I didn't leave my apartment for almost a week. And then I started taking like short walks outside of my apartment. And then like going to grocery stores when like the fridge is running low. So it was like, I was like trying to stay positive and just like, you know, like, oh, at least my roommates are gone. We don't have to share rooms. I can just like keep walking naked in my apartment. Like I have at least like other rooms that I can step into. I like change my environment from my own room, because at the time I took the ferry to the IKEA in Brooklyn to get a desk. Because I didn't have a desk in my apartment to work at, because I never work at my apartment, because Cooper's 24/7. No, Cooper's not 24/7 open, but it's close enough that if I want to work out, just go to school. So I had this like tiny ass desk that's like a secretary desk that like I used to have two large drafting desks in school to just do drawings, and like one to do drawings and make models, the other one to like to do computer stuff. And then so I had to also change all the plans that I had planned for a thesis to kind of like, because I couldn't make any models. I always say that my class is worse than the class that started in the pandemic, because we were planning to do the whole thesis without thinking about the pandemic. Then we had to do it under pandemic. There's no planning for what we had, like we just had, there's no plan that were made for what were happening. So it was not even like the problem of like making models. I don't have space to make models. It was like I couldn't even make small sketch models, because like the art supply stores are not open. So like if I start doing something, then I don't, like I used all the materials that I have to make those sketch models. There's no materials that I can supply myself to keep making iterations. So then the design process would be just like stuck there. So then I had to make this decision to like move everything digital, because pretty much like given the domestic infrastructure that was lack of, that was not even the problem, but actually because of the urban infrastructure. So I was not being able to like continue the study that I was doing. And so I don't know, this is, so I guess, look, there's so much happened so fast that like I just didn't really have time at that point to really think about like, oh, what happened during SARS? Like it was completely like everything is, every day is a new situation. But at the time, you know, I was like kind of just like taking it day by day, and then kind of, it was very peaceful to me, actually. It was not chaotic, because I think reflecting back, I knew that it would be a very, very deep hole if I become depressed at that point. So I sort of blocked myself to not become depressed at all. To be able to keep living in that situation. I'm very good at kind of compartmentalizing my thoughts, because of just, I think, trauma and like my past life. So I was able to do that and then kind of just think and look at the positive things that were in. And I made some actually very, very, some piece of sculptures that I was very proud of even till this day, with like stuff that I was just staring at in my apartment that it was also kind of cute, I guess. That was kind of like the summary of like the summer of 2020. Yeah.
May I ask what happened with graduation?
So we had a Zoom graduation, and then I mean, everything was kind of just a joke, like, and I, so like I knew everything's kind of a joke to begin with, so I don't really take it too seriously. I know everybody's trying to like just cope with it, including the faculties, the school, the president. So like everybody's going through it, like they're trying their best, we're trying our best, our parents are trying their best to like to catch up with whatever's happening. So like it was just, I don't, you know, it's like, I mean, looking back, all the work that was produced, like that were presented at a thesis, was also just kind of a joke, also because it was undergrad, like everybody was naive and like, you know. But then graduation, so for Cooper, there was this like half day YouTube pre-recorded session of those speakers speaking that had just being played. And then move on to the individual school's graduation with like the awards and like the dean speaking and everybody's like showing face on the Zoom. And then my parents, cause they're in China, so they couldn't even watch the YouTube thing cause YouTube is blocked. And then by the time I reflected this problem to the school, they're like, oh my God, we totally didn't think about this. I mean, so my parents were really upset because like they already don't know enough about what's happening in my life because of the intergenerational communication problem that we've been having, also because my gender and everything. So like these are some of the moments that are more public that I would, you know, make sure that like they could grab as much as they can because I would present myself also like less kind of like with less censored content from them because it's a public event. So it was really a pity that like they didn't even get to experience that. But I kind of, I don't know, I kind of thought everything was a joke to begin with, so I didn't really like have too much of like expectation versus reality, like disappointment. I mean, I think they did. But the second year we did like a in-person graduation with our class and the upcoming class as well. And I actually showed up to graduation in full drag. And that was the first time that I kind of did drag in public, I think. And that was great. And also that was benefited from my parents. I didn't tell my parents that we're doing this thing the second year. So then like they just don't know that like all of these photos were taken or like this event was happened. So I was able to kind of like, you know, being drag and like kind of do the graduation the way I personally would want it to. So yeah, that was nice. A good, sweet, tender reunion moment with a bunch of people, a lot of people that just haven't seen in a year.
Were you keeping in touch much with family back home while all of this was going on?
Yes. Our communication is frequent. We text at least every day and we try to video call every other week, I would say. That's the average frequency. But it was very, I mean, there's a lot of up and downs. Actually, the summer before the pandemic, it was the last time I went home. So this is 3 years back. And that was the time that I officially came out to my parents. So after that, I mean, there was a lot of like preparation work done before that point. Like I was preparing that event for like 3 to 5 years. But after that, that was kind of like the milestone when like, okay, I'm going to, you know, start pushing because the coming out process made me realize that they're still in denial. So then like, I need to keep pushing them to like engage with these materials and topics so they can like at least process little by little every day instead of just not mentioning it after coming out, then they're just not gonna, you know, get anywhere. So I was intentionally bringing up more and more like of my just life to them, that they never, I was never given the chance to learn about, and so that created a bunch of volatile moments and a lot of up and downs, because I think the argument was kind of just like, oh, like my mom's like, oh, you're not telling us anything, but then I'm like, I like, yeah, because like you guys don't want to hear anything that's like actually about my life, and whenever I tell you something, you just get so mad, or like just so much like feedback on like unasked for feedbacks of like my, I don't know, behavior whatsoever, that I'm like not asking you to critique me, basically. So I don't want to share because I didn't ask for this. And then they're like, why you're not sharing? And I'm like, I tried, and I just like, you know, like it's not well received. So it's just a lot of that back and forth during 2021 and then 2021 to the past year, I was working with a therapist kind of specifically focusing on the generational conversation. I think so that helped a lot. And this year we've been having a more communicative, more effective communication between us. So, and also in terms of the pandemic, this is also like it's also both ways, right? Because for them in China, like there would be huge waves of like large lockdowns, like for example in Shanghai earlier last year, and since my hometown is close to it, and my dad is a surgeon, like he had a lot to go through because he was also kind of like in some administrative role in the hospital. There would be times that my dad can't come home from hospital for a month straight, just living in the hospital for a month, 45 days straight, because they were like checking the travel history of every person that's coming in and out of the hospitals, including the doctors and nurses. So, and it was at a time that my mom broke her ankle because of all the stress that's pent up, also just between us. Like, I think she's just like very stressed, and so like was not being careful, as a result, not being careful enough, or like don't have energy to be careful enough, and then so broke her ankle. And then my grandma was doing a knee surgery as well. So just a lot of things are happening, it all kind of like went south within one week, and it was a very difficult week for me here in school as well. And that was kind of just like a volcano eruption moment when everybody's just accusing everyone for like something, and while nobody is really have the capacity to like be there for each other, even just in terms of communication and keep each other like posted. So yeah, and then like my mom and my dad was not like physically together because my dad is in the hospital and etc. And no one's like could take care of her. My mom with her broken ankle had to take care of my grandma after post surgery, and then my grandma had to take care of my mom, like with the ankle, even though she like couldn't really walk. Anyways, so yeah, so and then I felt really, really bad for, I guess, not being able to ask more, like, what's happening, like, more frequently, because I was focusing so much on my own, like, frustration towards their miscommunication their ways of communication, that I just didn't really, just forgot, like, oh, like, there's a lot happening on that side as well, and I should have, like, you know, be more communicative with what's happening in their lives as well. That was a moment in our family. Yeah.
What have been some of your sources of support during the pandemic?
I also started, I also met my partner during the pandemic. We are pandemic couples. So that was in January 2021. Yeah. So since then, everything got so much better because just it's been great. And so I'm really appreciative of that. And then before that, I was living, my friend and I decided to move in together and then move to Queens from Brooklyn for a larger apartment and a quieter neighborhood. And then that really helped because domestic space was what I was hoping to have, projecting myself into a longer pandemic, and some sense of nature, and like in a sense of like, oh, I can grow something like on the balcony, for example. So yeah, so living in Queens was, and also we're living in Amherst, it's a very Asian neighborhood, so I was blessed with like the home foods, and like they're so convenient to get the things that I crave every day waking up. It was the cute apartment that we set up for ourselves. We had decided to have three rooms for two of us instead of just two. And so we can have like a work room, and we have to work in our own bedrooms. That was a very, very deliberate decision that we made to like move to separate our sleeping and working while working from home. And we had a giant living room and a giant kitchen plus dining room. So our dining and living were separate, which is usually not the case living in New York. So we're really blessed with that. And then a huge balcony with a beautiful rack of like herbs and stuff that we started growing. So that was what really kept me sane during that year. And that was also the first year after graduating from Cooper and then actually living by ourselves in New York. So like it's a combination of like what was supposed to happen plus what was not expected, in terms of setting up my own like kind of my own life in the city that I've been in for almost it was like 5 years at that point. But I really appreciate that year, and then I think my understanding of neighborhoods in New York also changed a lot since that was the first time I lived in Asian community that I otherwise wouldn't choose to. I wouldn't move away from Brooklyn if this didn't happen. So reflecting back, because now I'm such like a pastoral person these days, like I'm like, New Haven is so nice, I don't want to move back to Brooklyn ever. But that personality kind of started during that year when I was in Queens. But we were also able to like, you know, go back, because Amherst is really interesting. It's also like just half hour away from Bushwick, so it was very convenient going back to Bushwick to like meet friends and like go to Highland Park for raves and stuff when none of these was like legally supposed to happen, but it happened. Sometimes I was there and it was great. And yeah.
What's it been like having a partner during the pandemic?
It's very special. It's very, okay. I guess in terms of pandemic, well, our honeymoon was like, so we met like late January 2021 and then early February 2021, we got COVID together. So then we had to quarantine together and then that was our honeymoon. And then, so I was able to cook extensively, cooking very elaborately during that week, just like made, and it was also Chinese New Year. So like, you know, I was making a lot of like big dishes that I would usually not do because it takes a lot of time. It takes a whole day to prepare. But also like I was living in Amherst, there's enough grocery options, Asian grocery options. We were able to get like live fish, fresh, like water tank fish and like other seafoods. And so that was really cute. And then ever since that week, I have not cooked that way yet. And it was, I mean, I guess it's not like, I don't know if this is specific to like the pandemic situation, but like for me, I kind of had a love and hate relationship with my aesthetics, like the things I like when it comes to like music particularly. I kind of never found the group of friends that like appreciate what I secretly appreciate. And I was also like, I mean, like I don't know, spending out college time at Cooper Union is also a very weird experience because like, oh, like you're all of a sudden exposed to all of these edgy artsy people in the city before you kind of formed your own like understanding or like perception of art in general. So we're constantly trying to align yourself to like your people that are in your face and like, oh, like is this cool, is that cool, is this like actually good stuff or is that like kitschy or not, like so there's a lot of like navigating like in the fog like when it comes to like I guess beauty and things that makes you feel good versus things that you think are good. So my partner is kind of the first person that I, and then, so she's a musician. And I shared some of my music to her and it was so like affirming for myself to be confirmed that like these are some things that she really enjoy as well. She didn't know about it before, and then so then like so that really set a tone of like my own confidence, I guess. And then so I was able to in the relationship, and I was able to like, you know, stay confident and like, and then that helped me to bring the best of me in front of her to make sure that, you know, she has a good experience when I'm around, I think. So that initial dynamic, I think it really set the tone, and then like so like the healthy relationship could have been just established till this day. That's one. And then two is kind of our own gender explorations. During the pandemic, we kind of both started as like cis gays at the time, and she started transitioning this year after like we sort of I don't know, we kind of confirmed a bunch of like feelings that we individually have both been feeling in terms of gender and sexuality. It was just never like be able to kind of like explored and practiced in our own ways, because she went to Juilliard, I went to Cooper. Again, we were exposed to all these already so processed in terms of gender, sexuality, the friends that in our lives, and then we're just different. So we kind of just blocked ourselves, you know, to process these topics on our own pace. So we kind of went through that together, but just like between two of us. And then that was really, really special, because I feel like I would have never, it was like the perfect timing and like situation and space to not feel like scared to be judged, to be like laughed at, being maybe ignorant or just not sensitive enough, like when we discussed these things. It was safe enough. It was safe enough time and space for both of us to like just like ask questions and like be like, who are we, what do we feel like wanna become, and all of these that, yeah. So she started transitioning this year, and I also really, I started identifying as non-binary only last fall when I arrived at Yale. So we kind of both like sort of reestablished our gender identities together in the past year and a half.
Other than COVID-19, what have been some of the social and political issues on your mind and heart over the last couple of years?
I mean, that's a very interesting question, because the Black Lives Matter also happened during the pandemic. It was, again, being exposed to all these topics in the 5 years when I was in undergrad, while not really involved in these topics, but that really kind of prepped me up to that point to like really process and like engage what was happening in the city. And there's this funny anecdote that during the peak of the protests, I think it was one weekend in the summer, our class decided to do like a little picnic upstate, and then so I rented a car and drove everybody up, and while we were there I took some shrooms, thinking that it was gonna calm down before we drive down. But I think because I messed up the timing with like eating food, I ate it after I ate, so my body didn't process until I processed the food. So it was, I was really, really high. And I still couldn't drive down, so my friend drove us down instead. But then I had to return the car after we got to the city. That I had to do myself. So I drove from Brooklyn to Tribeca on shrooms while everybody's out in the streets protesting. And helicopters above us, just like sirens everywhere. And it was just a moment of like, why I'm here, where am I, why I'm here, what is this time of in history, like when everything is just colliding together and all the stimulus, you know, like sound, lights, people's faces, movements of people, flocking of people, just all coming together. And then the radio, not the radio, it started playing a very sad version, like a piano version of Imagine, like a cover by, I forgot, somebody else, not John Lennon himself. In my car, when I was at the intersection of Bowery and Houston, with like the helicopter right above me, So that was a moment, I think, that marked my own like political education and then after the protests, that was when I really to start to like read and try to assimilate the conversations that are happening with like ACAB, with racial discussions, and that half of year prepared me to start doing work with Reconary Sign, because I had a better understanding of being Asian as well. I think the first sort of like active engagement that I participated, other than just going out to the street to protest, was to host people in Manhattan, because I was still living in Manhattan at the time, because people couldn't go back to Brooklyn because Brooklyn Bridge was blocked. So yeah, there were like a few nights that I just put up, you know, stories on Instagram, be like, if anyone need a shelter tonight, like feel free to come over. So I met some friends that are still like are friends with through those nights, and had great conversations. And yeah.
What was it like hosting strangers in the middle of a pandemic?
That's also a funny question, because as gays, we host strangers all the time. So I kind of didn't feel weird at all. It was just something I do literally every day. I will use some other anecdotes to talk about this, about hygiene and about strangers. I paused hooking up, obviously, when it first got locked down, but I think after maybe, I can't really remember exact, but maybe 2-3 weeks in, I reinitiated my efforts to have sex with people again. So, this is a great story. So there's this cop that he's a married cop, and he works at the precinct. Is that the word? Anyways, the bureau at in Alphabet City. And then so he, I guess he was also very pent up. He's a top in his relationship, but he's just like looking to suck dick outside of when he's cheating. So basically we were chatting, and then like he would come so also at the time, because I mentioned that I made some pieces of sculpture that I was very proud of, and one of them was this kind of like door curtain that was glued together with semen, and I argue that it's all by semen, but obviously there was some glue involved as well, but just like cum rags, tissues from my dustbin next to my bed, that's just like where all my cum rags go. So then it was like re-tessellated into this like this white curtain thing of just tissue paper, and then with a hole there, and I call it glory hole. And that was kind of my own artistic reflection of what was happening at the time. But then also with this dude, I was like, I actually have a glory hole set up. Do you want to use that? And then so this dude would come and then just like suck me for like an hour straight, because like he was like, it was set up as a whole like slave-ish like sexually moment. So like you just like coming on four and like climb, like I could be on Zoom like in a class, and he would like climb over and then start sucking me under the desk or something, like as I was still speaking to my professor. But then we also tried with this like the glory hole that it was made out of comp. It was, yeah, so it was, I guess I wasn't feeling weird, but it was just like I was recognizing the weird situation that we were in, and I was kind of practicing over it, and but also kind of like, you know, being creative, trying to be creative to like find ways to reflect on as like a fun side artistic gig situation, within my constant oscillation between want to be an architect or an artist struggle. Yeah.
What does the word health mean to you?
I think speaking as of today, I think to me really is about being able to enjoy the things that you want to enjoy in life. So there's the physical dimension and there's the psychological dimension to enable you to do so. And you need to be like, I think you need to be like able in both dimensions to be able to enjoy what you want to enjoy in life. Because I think happiness is something that your body generates when you enjoy as a verb, but like enjoying as a process, that's where happiness is generated. And I think health means that you have the mechanism to be able to do that. And then so yeah, I think health, I guess another thought just in my head is that like health is in that sense, health is not directly related to like pain or not pain, and because pain can be also enjoyable. I think enjoyment is like a more active, proactive process that like it's also about like your perspective, like how you look at this, how you feel about things. So it's more psychological to me these days, but then there is the physical like capability that you need to be able to practice the psychological dimension of that, if that's clear.
What are some of the things you think we would need to change as a culture to make that version of health and enjoyment available to everyone?
There's not enough therapists, psychoanalysts, psychiatrists available. I think I'm extremely privileged to be able to have a reflective personality so that I can actually process a lot of things by myself, even without the help of therapist. But even with somebody like me, it's so different when somebody else is guiding you through the process versus not. So I can't even imagine how people who don't have the reflective personality that I have, to be even like to you know, to process any of this. So, and I feel like processing is so important to be able to face and deal with what happened to you. So, because our brain often blocks, you know, what happened, because we would make decisions to not engage. The body remembers, and the which means it if even if you decided to tell yourself something didn't happen to you, it happened to you. And if you don't process, then there would never be a chance to be able to embrace whether it's like your own shortcomings or like whether it's something like some trauma that like you, I don't know how to frame this, like whether it's some external trauma that you experienced, and if you don't process, then you would never be able to overcome and then be free to talk about and experience the things that you're scared of, because you made a decision to be scared of those things. So we need more people practicing mental health, and so more people can be guided through their mental health problems and traumas, and so we can all discuss more things that are socially constructed to be not discussed with each other more. So we can flip this page that like just so many things we just can't discuss and process. Yeah.
What does the word safety mean to you?
It means that I can ask questions. It means that I can't. It means that I can ask questions. I think that's the ultimate safety that I can feel. To feel that I'm okay to be ignorant with maybe some of the questions that I'll be asking. And so, because that's the only way to learn about the things that you don't know about yet, and then so change the bad, the ignorant sides of you by asking these questions that are maybe are ignorant. So yes, that's the kind of safe space that I crave and I want to create for other people.
There's been this really narrow idea of safety in relationship to the body and COVID-19. I'm wondering, in that tiny biomedical framework, what are some of the things you've been doing to keep yourself feeling safer?
You mean in terms of like sanitation and like the psychological boundaries between people that's set up by these practices?
All of it.
I think not overstepping. I think acknowledging everybody has different understanding and comfort zones, and the size of these spaces are different. So I think asking and keep asking and keep vocalizing before you make any moves and actions is something that I've been feeling is very helpful when I interact with people these days, to make sure that you're not stepping into their space that sometimes you might not like aware that you're stepping into. And then that's more about communication rather than overprotection. I think protocols are necessary, but it's also like it's not I don't mean like whether it should be or should not be imposed onto everyone, but I think everybody's protocol is different, and then so like the differences between everybody's protocols. You just want to make sure that like it's aligned. I think that's the least that we should do to protect each other. And then that also, because that ties back to, you know, everybody's physical condition, somebody more like immune compromised, somebody, you know, so like a lot of times you just don't know why people practice a lot of protocols the way that they do, why they do that. So I think, and then a lot of times it's sensitive to ask. So I think by confirming that, like, this is the line, this is the boundary for you, and then everybody could be different, is very important to me.
Could you give me an example of one of the conversations you've had about those boundaries in relationship to COVID and safety?
Yeah, so one of the colleagues that Red Canary signed is a disabled immune compromised person. And we, you know, we've been hosting lots of community engagement events, like mutual aid events, or like just like visiting parlors, or like gatherings, vigils, like a lot of these things with the good intention of, you know, during the pandemic, everybody need to like just spend time, more time with each other. At times we would kind of get loose on, you know, sanitizing, and like partially because like how the community that we are outreaching to, again, it's their, that's their protocol. So then like sometimes we just kind of tag along with how they practice it. And then it was very harmful, actually, and upsetting to this one colleague, because they felt left out because they couldn't participate in these kind of events given their own condition with their own body. So, and then we still haven't found a good way to figure this out, because we want to host these events because that's what the community needs and wants because of the pandemic. But meanwhile, exactly the situation that they want is what our colleague just can't do. So that's, I think, a good story of like, you know, the line is very blurry. It's there's sometimes not a perfect solution for everyone. And I guess in that case, the response is just like going back to like the conversation with organizing. Not everybody can do everything. Like sometimes it's just like some people with some people, some other people with some other people. It's not personal, and then it's like puzzles coming together. If it doesn't happen, it's just not meant to be. But yeah, that was, yeah, the one of the anecdotes, I guess.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
How immediate, like tomorrow? Or, I'm very stressed in general with like lots going on academically and in life as well. And there's a lot of like juggling between New Haven and New York for me right now. That's very challenging. And I'm also feeling that I'm onto something that's very important. The projects are underway to something more magnificent that I feel like I'm adding more weight to the things that I'm doing. And a lot of it is come from the experience of the pandemic and my organizing experience during the pandemic. So I guess it's a sweet struggle to be in, to be like, this is too much. I'm always overcommitting myself to things, but also like there are the good things to be committed to. But I was also, I just started with a new psychoanalyst last week, so that really eased my situation. Or projecting to the future, I feel like I'll be fine for a good while, since now I'm starting to be able to work with a psychoanalyst. I didn't have a therapist since like June to like last week, and that was kind of like a lot to put up with. Yeah, that's what's on my mind.
What are some of your hopes for a longer term future?
I hope. Oh, I don't know. There's so many hopes that I have. I hope I'm more. I hope I'm more true. I recognize my own existence more, as in like, as I mentioned, I'm constantly in this oscillation between wanting to do art versus doing architecture, like, or wanting to, I don't know, like boost my sex work or wanting to like boost my academic work, and you know, there's a lot of these like opposite things that I both want to do, but then like realize that I probably can do both. And then I think in the past I was like, you know, like I need to choose one, I need to like make a decision, I need to like commit it to one path and then take the others as side gigs. But I think I want to recognize this state more and then be like, that's maybe just who I am, and then that's okay. Like, it doesn't have to be art or architecture. It can be just like focusing on what I'm doing and then evolve that to become its own practice. And whatever that is, it is what it is. And as long as it's, you know, it I'm proud of it, and I think it's meaningful, and like it's good work. So I'm trying to like, I hope that I'll be able to be more comfortable with this kind of oscillation that's in my everyday. And I hope I can talk to my parents more. I hope I can be more articulate. And I feel safe with them, and I hope that I can feel more and be less rigid and a little bit more messy. And I hope that my partner and I can stay true to our experiences with each other, and just keep this good dynamic going. Yeah.
Do you think of COVID-19 as a historic event?
I mean, I think history to me is the accumulation of past experiences. I mean, this is very Freud, but it's all sorts of experiences that are not just visual or sound, or it can also be sense, like movements and all sorts of sensations and experience, distant or immediate. So it definitely is historical, but I don't know if we put the word event in, what does it mean here? Because it's like, I mean, I'm sure it is like 100 years later, like in a history book, like this is an event, but I think it's more complicated than that. And I think that's exactly why I was really excited about this project, because it gets to, you know, like bring in more facets of experiences and ambiances that collateral to the three sentences that would describe COVID as an event. And yeah.
What, if anything, do you think scholars in the social sciences and humanities should be doing right now to help us understand the human side of the last couple of years?
I don't know. I'm not a scholar, and I'm not in academia. I don't even know what is going on right now already. I can only speak from my very, very immediate experience with reviewing the Situationist International collection at the Beinecke, that that's some kind of important work to do, to look at the ambience, at least for my own industry, like in architecture. Like, we need to look at urban spaces, like as in like our psychological perception of the urban spaces these days, and then that's kind of so neglected in the discourse, at least in my school right now, I think. And also the work of on solidarity, and we're just too super, me included, too superficial to, like, you know, being a Ivy League institution and fly somewhere for 2 days to like take a look at the community, and then argue that we are researching on the community, and then feeding what they're feeding and trying to solve their problems when nobody shows up to unionization meetings. So, I mean, of course, there's more conversation happening around these topics in academia, but I just think there should be more. There should be way more, and it's not a yes or no question. It's like you can't, it's not about like, oh, like you decide to like talk about labor or not, talk about solidarity or not, organizing or not. It's everybody chipping in 1 cent a day so that this movement can keep going with or without your 1 cent today. So I think the heroism that's always there for like, oh, you know, I mean, that is true in every industry, should be really dissolved into like small, like nameless contributions to more things, more topics, but like less, it's also less about careerism, I guess. So yeah, that's where my headspace is right now in terms of this.
This is my last question. I'd like you to imagine speaking to a historian in the future, someone far enough away that they have no lived experience of right now. As they go forth with their studies, what would you tell them cannot be forgotten about right now?
Oh, that's a loaded question. The fog, the confusion, the disorientation, Nobody knows what, I don't think anybody knows what we're doing today, but also we're also trying our best to figure out what we're doing. So we're constantly in a state of disorientation, but also searching for a path, and work or experiences are being produced in this experience of navigating through the fog. And the fog itself, I think, cannot be forgotten, because it's real. It's, you can see it because you don't see things.
Well, I thank you so much for the generosity of your time and the kindful wisdom in your answers. Those are all of the questions I know how to ask at the moment. So I'm wondering at this point, if there's anything you'd like to share that my questions haven't made room for, please take some space and share it.
Yeah, I guess just one note on something that I think I assumed too much of what condition everybody lives under. When it comes to the pandemic, it was the first time that I realized actually a lot of people don't know how to use their phones. A lot of people living in New York don't read or know any or can speak any English. Living in New York, don't know how to get around the city with getting on subway. Can only communicate with vocal accounts. So when it comes to work, organizing, or like whether it's academia, scholarly or not, it is so narrow if we only operate, if we only assume the world operates on the ways that we operate, and then so use those as, like, assume those as the universal methods and means to understand and go get through this world. And so because when everybody start doing that, the people who don't have access to whatever it is that they don't have access to, that is considered as the universal tool for whatever purpose of living the life, gets further marginalized, and these marginalizations get amplified when things like pandemic happens. And anybody can break at any point. Nobody's strong. Growing up, I always have the idea of the strong people versus the not strong people. I think everybody can break at any point. And then it's not a matter of your own tenacity. It's a matter of like the timing and where, like the place, the time that you're in, with your whatever is going on in your mind that can trigger, to crush someone, and then that can happen to anyone. And that doesn't mean you're not strong or anything. But also, like, for the people who don't think that's their problem, I don't know. It's rendered in so different dimensions on other bodies and other people that we can never imagine. So just like give each other space and time, and care, why we're all in this together.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You have very, very good questions.